Michael, welcome to the podcast. I appreciate you, taking the time.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I took very long to get back to you with dates and stuff. I apologize. I was like kind of overwhelmed since I started freelancing. Today we're talking homesteading. I just want to find out, you're currently the editor of a lifestyle block magazine, right?
Yeah. So New Zealand Lifestyle Block. I edit that, and it's a monthly publication, and it's I would call it a homesteading magazine now since I took over it, because it basically regularly explores those themes of self-sufficiency and small farming and I guess all the things that people are doing on small blocks of land, small rural land, not full farms, but farmlets, shall we say. Under kind of 50 hectares is generally the size that of the properties I feature in the magazine.
Yeah. So is that your magazine, or are you working?
No, there's the publishers that are, they also publish New Zealand Life and Leisure, which is a another lifestyle magazine. And yeah, so we kind of sit alongside that, so like the sister magazine.
Okay. And then what's your background? Journalism, how did you get into this?
Journalism. Actually, I did it quite late. I was involved in heaps of things. You know, I was a music teacher and a greenskeeper and a groundskeeper and in sales and quite a bit. And then I did my postgrad in journalism about 5 or 6 years ago. And then worked at the spinoff for a bit. And then went to business desk. And then I bought a lifestyle block, and then this job popped up as editor of Lifestyle Block magazine. And I think that's probably how I got the gig.
Cool.
I've just bought one, and I'm going to be, you know, exploring it and learning heaps. And they thought, well, perfect. This is a great opportunity for you to learn and share about your experience. And I think they wanted a fresh eye. Yeah.
Fresh perspective.
When you've been in the game for so long, you start to get fixed in your ways, but they probably saw me as being open to anything. And it's been a sweet job. It's been the best job I've had, for sure.
That's cool. It's like two stuff just aligning at the same time, buying it, interview, and boom, you've got it.
Yeah.
So how did you physically within the Lifestyle Block magazine start transitioning to more what is homesteading? Let's try and define it.
Yeah, well, it depends on where you are in your definition, but I would say the broadest definition is an American concept.
Yeah.
And homesteading itself is traditional homesteading. It pertains to the idea of a homestead on a ranch or a big rural property, and it's like a traditional subsistence farming household.
Yeah.
But modern homesteading, which is what a lot of people practice today, is kind of like takes those principles but is applying it more broadly. Like anyone can be a homesteader. They don't necessarily have to live rurally these days. So it's kind of called modern homesteading. You're still doing the same things. You're practicing self-sufficiency and self-reliance. You're growing a lot of your own food, storing and preserving a lot of your own food, and your subsistence farming and growing, if your land is capable of that as well. But I would say, the best way to describe it is the practice of self-sufficiency.
Okay. So did you kind of now, are you now naturally with the magazine transitioning into that kind of mindset? Like what's the difference between Lifestyle Block and homesteading? Like is there a difference to you, or is it now merging? Like what's happening with the magazine?
Well, I would say that the traditional lifestyle block market or sector, shall we say, has been a bit more conventional in that a lifestyle block is a person who moves out of the city and buys a big plot of land and then kind of, you know, takes on this way of life as a lifestyle on the side. You know, they're just practicing it for fun. You know, they're keeping a few animals and keeping a few chickens and, you know, having a good time and just trying to keep their land in a manageable state. A lot of people who traditionally own lifestyle blocks would also work their other jobs on the side.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be full-time on the land. I would say homesteading is a lot more deliberate and a lot more purposeful, where people are choosing a real conscious way of life on their properties. And a lot of them are actually doing away with their jobs and they're choosing to live off the land full time.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I took over the magazine, I saw it. I saw an opportunity to explore this new style of living that people were practicing. And it's a big movement, I have to say. A lot of people are choosing to do it, especially since COVID.
Yeah.
You know, live on their land and really want to restore it and grow as much food as possible and take it really seriously. And so I saw it as quite an earnest movement. So I really wanted to explore that, and kind of no other magazine in New Zealand is doing it, in fact. So I really thought it was great to try to have the monopoly on that kind of content.
Yeah, for sure.
The magazine's called Lifestyle Block, but I would say it's more leaning towards homesteading, self-sufficiency. It's just a coincidence that this homesteading self-sufficiency is happening on what we would call lifestyle blocks.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah,
it's more like a terminology. The lifestyle block is the terminology, but the mindset is the homesteading something like that. So you've kind of answered the question, but where do you become a homesteader? And you're not someone who's got a veggie garden and a couple of chickens anymore. Is it like your intention? Like, how does that transition happen?
But yeah, I would say someone becomes a homesteader when they decide to regularly practice that way of life, I guess, when they're growing their own food with the intention of relying less on supermarkets and relying less on the corporate system of food, and where they're basically using the resources on their land to generate self-sufficiency.
Yeah. Do you think such a person necessarily thinks the corporate system is bad, or do they just kind of, is it just kind of that independent spirit that they've got and they kind of like the idea of doing all that stuff themselves?
I think it's a bit of both. And I think since COVID, it didn't necessarily prove that the system is bad, but it showed that the system is vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that people who rely on the system are vulnerable because the supermarkets were out of stock. There were panic buying, and also the state of, I guess, New Zealand's food system. So relying so heavily on an import market, people who are aware of that, it is a cause for concern because there are so many factors that can hamper or cripple that system when you're relying on it so absolutely. So, yeah, I think a lot of people have these kind of twin purposes of learning about these new practices and being more independent in themselves, but by also relying less on that vulnerable system.
Yeah. We fully intended, my wife and I, to start at least having our own eggs, but then we had two American Wyandotte chickens, but then my dog decided she likes the chickens more than we like the eggs. So we got home one day and it was like she came to greet us with like a lot of feathers in her mouth, and I realized terriers and chickens don't. Like the previous night, the chickens were sleeping on the dog. You know, they were buddies, but I assume they ran or something, and then something triggered in her brain. So that's how far I've come. And
down in the South Island?
Yeah, we're in the South Island, but this was pre New Zealand when I was still living in South Africa. And here I said recently I'll just start hunting for my own meat and fishing for my own meat. And I've said this, I think, on a couple of podcasts actually, but I usually catch and release fly fish, but since I decided to catch all my own fish, I just caught basically like really tiny fish. So, you know, something. Yeah. But anyways, so the word homestead is very associated with the American model, like you said, and it's almost like these prepper type mentality, which has a negative connotation to it there, more or less. But in New Zealand, it's almost a positive connotation because you've got rivers that within a day flood. You've got infrastructure that collapses just because of the terrain. Do you think like homesteading is like seen in a more positive light here than without kind of that weird sometimes associations of America? I mean, I associate with positive things in America also, but I know there's like a bit of like a, do you think it's very positive in New Zealand?
I think, yeah, the people who practice it and know about it have very positive perception of it,
yeah.
Especially since COVID and especially since the floods. Homesteading to me was different from this idea of together quite closely, because self-sufficiency is about being prepared, and that's what prepping is. It's just about being prepared. And I know there's negative connotations, but after the Hawke's Bay flood, the people who were prepared were actually in a far better position, not only to help themselves, but to take the strain off emergency resources and help other people. Like quite a few people I interviewed after the floods were able to feed other people because they had reserves of food. They had, you know, home killed in their freezers, and the freezers ran on solar power. They had preserves stored. Their properties were bought and developed being with the intention of being secure in natural disasters. And so, yeah, one guy I spoke to, even his own digger, you know, that's how much his kind of self-sufficiency extended, that he could just get out his digger and start clearing roads himself. So I think that's amazing if people can pursue this way of life. His self-sufficiency was so well honed that, yeah, he had a little rhino digger, like 1 meter wheelbase, 1 meter tracks, tiny little wee thing, but he was able to start clearing roads and driveways of his neighbors and, you know, clear the road right down to the main village of Eskdale, I think, which was one of the hardest hit places. So these people are not only in a position to help themselves, but they're able to use their self-sufficiency to help others and help their communities. And I think that is one of the things that's overlooked with this whole world, is that people, when they're self-reliant, can stand on their own two feet and then can help others get back up on their feet as well.
Yeah, for sure. I before moving to New Zealand, I wasn't that aware of natural disasters, you know. But since moving here, I think with seeing flooding, even just while hiking, you know, it's big rain event and suddenly the river's high. Earthquake, volcanoes, you know, you've got that in the back of your mind. And I know I've got like food stored, and it might just be camp food, you know, but I'm aware that I need to be able to take care of myself for 3 days. But yeah, that does free you up in some way to be able to start helping neighbors who kind of cannot do that.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned before the negative portrayals of homesteading and prepping, because of this American perception of like doomsday preppers.
Yeah.
And I guess who arm themselves with weapons and are preparing for social collapse and the ugliness that will come from that. But I don't think New Zealand preppers and homesteaders, at least the ones I know and that I'm familiar with on social media, and there's a big community of them, they don't act that way. They're not prepping for collapse. They're just prepping to take care of themselves and be in a good position to, it's like when you take care of your health, you know, you do so not to as a competition with other people or to be healthier than others. You're doing it to when something comes along, you're not going to be as susceptible and you're going to be in a position to keep going.
For sure.
So I think, yeah, it's got a real, there's a real healthy communal mentality that comes with homesteading as well in New Zealand.
It's interesting that you mentioned health. You know, if you eat healthy, that's actually one of the few things you can control, because you don't know what's coming, but you can control what you put in your body. And then homesteading in a way then also kind of gives you a bit of control about external things that you don't have control over. The Americans have a 40-acre thing. I'm sure you're aware of that, where But it's a lot amongst the hunters where they kind of grow a bit of crop, so they'll know they'll attract birds for bird shooting in season, and some deer will come through. Have you heard of that concept? Is that kind of the American homesteading view on it, or is the 40-acre thing not something that's come to your attention?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen any instances of it here in New Zealand. A lot of the homesteaders I have met and talked with have smaller blocks than that, maybe 10 acres, maybe, yeah, you know, 15 or even smaller. And yet they still practice the same thing. The principles apply. So yeah, I don't think there's any set criteria or definition. Yeah, I would just say the more, I mean, there's a bit of a balance with land, because at some point, if you have such a big space, you have to do something with it. It becomes more viable to be a farmer, yeah, than it does a homesteader. And I know that there are a lot of farmers who are homesteaders, but I think, yeah, you can't have too big a land if you're not doing something with it, because you'll just have too much stock if you choose to do that you can manage without turning it into a viable business.
For sure. That makes complete sense. So you say you're in Auckland at the moment, but you've got a piece of land in Waikato. Where more or less is it based?
It's in Raglan.
Oh, cool. Raglan is awesome. And what are you doing on it at the moment? You mentioned you plant some things, like what are you planting, or do you have animals? Like, yeah, how's it look at the moment?
It's bare land, so it's just a paddock with a building platform. It's sloping, and it's on the coast.
Yeah.
And I've just been planting shelter, because out there wind is the big the big nemesis that I need to prepare for. It's got great soils, but the wind is gonna make it difficult to grow any food out there. So at the moment I've just been putting in some really fast growing natives, quite a few really fast growing pioneer trees like Tagasaste and Tetonia, which is this Bolivian sunflower which grows really fast.
Awesome.
So quite a few of the trees I'm using are kind of permaculture staples, where they're really advocated because they have a lot of uses, and you can keep reusing them on your property. Like, use them once you prune them, you can use that material for mulch to spread around and really nurture the soil. So those trees are kind of, I planted them over the last year, and some of them have gotten away, and they're about 6 feet high, which is quite good. And so early next year, we'll be building a little house on there as well.
Okay, cool.
And then after that, we'll be able to live there. So hopefully halfway through next year, before winter, it might be done. It's a pretty small house, and a real simple one at that. But yeah, no, it'll be really a great thing to be able to live on the land and start putting these methods and theories into practice.
That raises another question, transitioning, because, you know, a person actually needs a whole chunk of money to go, like, I'm in the city tomorrow, I'm on a homestead. You know, that's not viable for most people. So you think a year is a good, or 2 years is a good transition time, or is that, I mean, that's just situation dependent?
Yeah, well we actually did it an interesting way, in that we put the offer on about 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And bought the land 2.5 years ago. So it's been that long we've had to wait to live on it. And not many people will do that, because, I don't know, people want to live in their house sooner. But because we've done it that way, and we've, I guess, put up with not having a home, we were able to buy it for a reasonable price off the plans, subject to title. And then, I guess, play the waiting game and slowly put together more and more money to build the house. I think if you wanted to do it, you know, straight away, it would cost a lot of money. And it would probably be a bit of a shock too, like moving from a city straight onto a piece of rural land. But fortunately, these last 2 years have given me a lot of opportunity to learn and meet people and just chat with interesting people and learn what they're doing. So yeah, I feel like it's been an actual gift to accumulate all this knowledge and be a bit more prepared, because the thing with these properties is people burn out because they take on so much.
Yeah.
And especially if they want to do homesteading, because it's a full-on gig, you know. You got to constantly be working to grow your food and then harvest your food and preserve your food and then and manage it all without wastage, whilst taking care of all the other things on the property as well.
Yeah, I can imagine, because that is full time, or it's at least a couple of hours per day. So now that you've spoken to a number of people, one for your podcast, let's just please plug the podcast. We're going to talk about it later. It's called The Pumpkin, right?
Yeah, it's called The Pumpkin.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and it's a homesteading podcast. So you've had time to like talk to a lot of people, which I assume is super valuable, because you know you might have put in some drain system, and now that you've spoken to five or six people, you know, actually I should use drain Y and not drain X. If you have a magic wand and you jump 5 or 10 years ahead, how's that piece of land of yours look?
Well, it's always going to be in work of progress. I don't think I'll aim for any kind of perfection or finished product, because that's where people get frustrated and they end up selling their property because they want it to look a certain way. But it's definitely going to have mature, or at least teenage trees on it by that point that are blocking out the wind. I hope that there's sufficient shelter in place. I want there to be enough gardens that are protected from the wind to feed my family, and also have surplus left over to, you know, share with other people. It's going to have chickens. I really want a couple of grazing animals on there, either a couple of sheep or even a house cow.
Yeah,
I have to do some more research into the amount of land we could give to pasture.
Yeah.
And whether that's viable for a cow and her calf, it's kind of borderline, because the property's a hectare. We'd probably be using about a third of it in like human living space, and then I could do two thirds of a hectare for grazing. Depending on different people you talk to, that's enough. But then other people go, "Oh no, you'll run out of grass, and then you'll have to buy and feed and." And it's also to do with the climate as well. Like, it's really windy, so I wouldn't want an animal out there to be uncomfortably exposed to the elements if they weren't suited for that type of climate.
Sheep could even be more viable, just because they need less land, and you can buy a lamb and just raise it for a couple of months before slaughter. But the cow obviously brings in milk, so
we eat a lot of lamb in our household, so I'd be happy with something that just provides food in the form of milk and manure, actually, because it's such a valuable resource, having that fertilizer on hand. And that's the whole thing about homesteading as well, is that people and the animals that they keep provide multiple uses. It's not just seen one-dimensionally as like, oh, here's some meat. It's like the animal's part of the system, and they graze, they keep the grass down, they provide manure, they provide meat, and obviously they provide companionship for a time as well.
When you tell people you're working into this, let's say family members, are they all like, awesome idea, or do some of them think like, yeah, that's weird, you know, because people are so used to just kind of town living?
I don't think my wife is too keen on being a homesteader, to be honest, because
that's funny.
I think I'm going to be taking it on myself. I don't think she wants to kind of spend her life bottling plums or kind of rendering fat in the kitchen. And she's got her own job, so she's got her own goals and dreams, but she's going to definitely enjoy having fresh food from the garden and cut down on our food budget as well. And I say it's not about, I'm not aiming for self-sufficiency, because that would mean that I wouldn't be able to do my job, edit a magazine. It's a full-time gig being self-sufficient, I just have desires to not depend so much on our supermarkets, and at least grow a portion of our own food and just have fun, you know, and just enjoy it. I just love being outside and I love the process. Even if it didn't yield anything, I'd still probably enjoy it.
Yeah. I've got that same desire for a piece of land and kind of to be self-sufficient when you need to, or to a certain extent, you know, just for the enjoyment of it also and kind of learning. Do you hunt or fish?
I fish, yeah. I used to fish quite a bit, and then I stopped for a while because, I don't know, I guess I was just in my in a different phase in life, but I've started to get into it. And hunting, yeah, I actually haven't got into a lot of hunting, but it's something I want to do. And yeah, quite a few of my mates go out and it just looks awesome. I think it's a whole part of it as well. You know, it's a great source, a great resource and way to get good meat and get it in bulk too, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I hunt and if you shoot a big animal like a red deer that's mature, it's just my wife and I, but you've got a lot of meat. In South Africa, I used to hunt blue wildebeest, and that would keep us an entire year. And that year awesome. Would include bringing people over for massive, like after I hunted one animal, because I usually hunted once, maybe twice a year, that was sufficient. And if you're bringing home like 120 kilograms of meat, we used to make like a massive like venison pie and bring over like, you know, 15 friends and just celebrate that.
And it's just the best kind of meat as well, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I'd recommend trying to get into hunting just because of the enjoyment of being outside. But putting something as massive in a freezer and knowing that that's secure for quite a long time is pretty cool. Do you, I mean, obviously you said you're not on your property yet, but how big a feature is trading in this community? Like, you know, you give me vegetables, I give you eggs. Is that kind of part of the deal?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everyone I've talked to who's homesteading is practicing that type of exchange in some way or another. Because everyone's land is different, so it's suitable to different production.
Yeah.
Some friends of mine who are on my podcast down in Raglan, they have a kind of food forest. So it's a lot of tropical fruit and they have goat milk. And so that's their, they've got those resources to trade with others, whether that be what they can't grow on their land, seafood, meat that someone's hunted, or even like materials.
Yeah.
That's a big one as well, you know. It all depends on what you need, but yeah, it's a great philosophy of bartering and I guess using what people have rather than going out and buying more things. Everyone's got something you might want, and if you have the capacity to offer them something, then that works really well.
There's a farmer about an hour north of Invercargill that we go and help shoot out deer on his farm, and he recently got $78 for a lamb because the lamb price has dropped really low. And he used to get, I stand to be corrected on the price, but let's say $110-$120 per lamb. So this is like a real big drop. You know, I'm more than happy to pay him for a lamb, $100 or $110. He gets the price he really wants, because I sat in a restaurant this week and paid $35 for a lamb shank. So he's getting $5.80 per kilogram. I paid $35 for a lamb shank, okay? But the rules here are, or the regulations are, that I cannot buy a home kill from him. And I think that really needs to be reinvestigated, because it can assure better income for the farmer if the lamb price is low, and it can mean I get something directly from the farm. And I wish that there could be someone working on those regulations.
I agree. It's really bizarre how hard it is for someone to practice that small scale model where they're able to sell their meat at that kind of farmer market or farm gate level. It's just ridiculous that it panders to this large scale corporate thing where everything's centralized, and
it is strange. It
just doesn't suit the small farmer, and it actually prohibits a lot of people from making a livelihood out of this.
Yeah. Obviously there are like food safety and animal health regulations surrounding it, but you know, there should be a quicker avenue for farmers to go to the Ministry of Primary Industries and say, I want to do this. This is where I'm going to slaughter it. I'm going to trade, you know, X amount of animals, maybe not their whole herd, maybe just a small amount. And then to, you know, have an inspection done at least and have that given the okay, because I really think, especially in times now where the lamb price is so low, you know, there are people making not a lot of money from selling a lot of animals, and they could be making double that. So how do you prioritize for your own piece of land, like the money you spend? Because you said you've started planting trees. Next is a house. But what happens after that? Just moving in and kind of just settling down into normal life, and then vegetables, or like how have you got that planned in your head?
I think I've just kind of been putting I just naturally put money towards it as a priority instead of doing other things, like, you know, we don't really go out for meals or anything like that, or and we're not going on holidays often. We just keep, you know, do camping trips in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So I think, I just naturally put money towards trees, and I actually propagate most of my trees by seed. So that's a big savings as well. And it's quite fun just experimenting with the different techniques to get them to germinate. It doesn't actually cost anything. Really, it's like, you know, you pay $4 for a pack of 100 seeds and you've got maybe 50 of those are viable, whereas they would cost $5 a seedling. It's just the time you put into it, but if you enjoy it, it's not really a sacrifice at all. And everything else, I would probably just create a little bit of a fund on the side and put money into it to pay for all those things, and then eventually it would be a direct transfer from the food budget towards things for the garden, because that's reducing the food budget anyway, you know. If you can grow your own lettuces or you grow your own broccoli, that means you don't have to buy them from the supermarket. So, save money and then put it back into the land.
When you fish, did you in the ocean or freshwater?
I actually haven't done any freshwater fishing. All been in the ocean. Yeah, we were up in Northland fishing on the weekend and just fishing off the rocks. Near Whangarei Heads, and that was really cool.
Yeah, the thing with both fishing and hunting is the time you have to put into it. You know, I've had days where I've had rivers where I just had really good days, and I go back the next time and then just nothing. And then you go like, man, I wanted to take something home to eat, and now I'm coming home empty-handed.
But it's another one of those things you. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking to myself, it's just nice doing it. You know, I don't actually care if I catch anything. It's just really nice to be out here and just kind of be observing my surroundings and be with the elements and kind of taking that all in.
Where do you learn? Obviously, you're learning because you're in the magazine. What other avenues, social media, like what do you follow? What do you read to learn?
I learn a lot through obviously talking with people, but there are some resources and some people I follow on social media that I learn a lot from. Jill Swinton is a really amazing homesteader down in Central Otago, and she's kind of got her system sus. She's always sharing about what she's doing, and again, she puts in a lot of work, but she shares helpful tips about how to preserve, how to pressure can, how to effectively manage her chickens, basically everything. She's running the full gamut of homesteading. I find homesteading aligns quite strongly with permaculture, because permaculture principles are kind of the enabler of homesteading.
Yeah.
So there's a permaculture operation in Northland called Permadynamics, and they have a community. You pay like, I don't know, $20 a month or something, and you get access to their website, and they have all these resources, videos and content that basically shows people how to grow abundant food forests and pick the right plants and all these different techniques for getting, I guess, the best out of your property and nourishing your soil so it's productive as possible. So I learn a lot from them. And then Twin Falls Nursery, they share amazing videos on their Instagram page.
Is that local?
They're in Northland as well. So they're okay. They're near Whangarei. They just have these great, really digestible short videos about, you know, basically it comes down to, a lot of the time it comes down to plant choices, because not everything is going to thrive on a property, not every plant, but if you pick the right plants and then you understand how the diversity of plants works together, things will flourish on their own as nature intended, I suppose. It's like the antithesis to monoculture farming. If you plant enough diverse species, you will create abundant food systems so easily and so naturally. And I think that's probably the biggest learning that I've had.
It's like a companion plant type of vibe, where the one and the insects maybe that it draws kind of feed off each other to create, like, you know, a pest-free environment. Is that basically what you're talking about also?
Yeah, companion planting, but it's also quite diverse in the theories behind it. Like, there's this idea that if you plant, there's a lecturer or an agroecologist named Christine Jones in Australia.
Yeah.
And she says that it's not about planting different species of plants. It's about planting a diversity of plant families.
Yeah.
So you've got species and then the genus and then the family. And if you have multiple families, representatives from different families in your planting area, they will flourish because they all complement each other. Their root lengths are different. Their feeding cycles are different. Whereas if you have all plants of the same species together, they're competing with one another. And that's why New Zealand has such a kind of fertilizer treadmill with our ryegrass pastures.
Yeah.
Because it's all one species that's crippling each other and they can't grow abundantly. So we have to put heaps of fertilizer on them in order to stimulate their growth. So if you go the opposite way and grow heaps of families, they will flourish like in a forest, like in any forest.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was thinking about something similar about the American and the South African grazing models. So cattle grazing in South Africa is mostly on native grasses, and those grasses are, well, so good that they've been commercialized. So you can buy the native grass seeds and plant them to feed your cattle. So entire like 2,000 hectare farms will have only native species that the cattle forage of, and multiple species also. So you've got a system there where you're grazing cattle, it's grass fed, but they're feeding off the grasses that would have grown in that area in any case, and the different ones that have, like you say, different sorry, I'm not English and I just forgot the word for root. Yeah, sorry. They've got different root lengths, you know, and root systems. And that is the ideal if you can do something like that. Are you planting mostly native species, or is it a mixture of kind of native and non-native species?
I actually planted only natives.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I went wrong. And I'm going to be going wrong a whole lot. I think that's probably how I'll learn, is by making mistakes. But I just planted 5 different species of native fast growing shelter belt trees.
Yeah.
And three of them, I planted 100 of them at first, and three species did quite well. And then two didn't, they just fell over. So they don't like it there. And I realized it's probably the reason is I just kind of planted them in that really conventional, just out in the open, you know, like 5 meters between each tree.
Yeah, yeah.
Like individual trees in those spacings to face the elements on a really windy site. I mean, yeah, they're not going to be happy, even though they're hardy trees. Like, but if you provide a diversity around them to nurture them and protect them and grow as a community, they're going to all do well together. So that's kind of what I've been doing now, is just going around those original natives and putting in these exotic fast growing trees like nitrogen fixing comfrey and nasturtiums, and as I said, Tittonia, to that, which will help keep the kaikuyu down, and all of these different plants that are going to help keep the invasive grasses at bay. Because it's got a big problem with kaikuyu, which I'm sure you'll be familiar with where you come from.
I am. I know people here don't like kaikuyu at all.
I like it. I mean, I think it's interesting because, yeah, I didn't like it at first. And, you know, as a Kiwi, you're kind of indoctrinated to hate these things like kaikuyu and possums and all these invasive organisms. But the kaikuyu is valuable because it actually forms a natural buffer along the fence line. Like if you keep it down, it almost forms a wall.
Oh, so yeah.
It's like filtering out the wind. And also I chop it back with a weed eater, and I can use it as a mulch. Like it makes a really good mulch once it's dry. So yeah, finding ways to use it and I don't use any poisons. I don't use glyphosate or anything. So it's always going to be there, but it's just finding ways to incorporate it and using it in the system.
So your podcast, The Pumpkin, how many episodes have you done now?
I think I've only done 4. So I started it about 4 months ago. So it was originally meant to be fortnightly, but it's become monthly, as I mentioned before.
Yeah.
But I've probably done about 10 interviews. I've recorded 10. I've just only released 4. But yeah, it's good. It's fun. And it's for me, it's an easy way to hit 2 birds with 1 stone, because many of these people I'm interviewing for my magazine anyway.
Yeah.
So it's I would do that talk. And so it's just a case of recording it and then releasing a podcast and writing a story. So yeah, it works out quite well.
And the Lifestyle Block magazine, is that weekly or monthly?
That's a monthly, yeah.
Okay. And where can people find that? Everywhere, supermarkets?
Worlds and gardening stores, Whitcalls and Paper Plus, and that can subscribe online. I think you interviewed Angela Clifford.
Yes.
Recently, didn't you? Yeah, she's one of our regular writers.
Oh, okay, cool, awesome. Yeah.
Regularly in there, so she's great. She's got some great ideas, and she's a real she's practicing this stuff all the time. She knows a lot, the wealth of knowledge.
Yeah, that was an interesting talk to her, because she's got the complete mentality of food security. And
yeah,
that's very interesting. So when are you going down to the no sorry you're going down up down when are you going down to Raglan again to work on your property?
Next week, probably. Yeah, I'll go down with my about several hundred little seedlings to plant out, and I'll take the weed eater, and I'll spend the day
prepping for next year.
Yeah, putting stuff in.
And when you put a home up, have you got a specific idea of like a tiny house, or have you got something in mind that that you want to put up?
It's not we were keen on a tiny house, but it's actually harder to get funding for a tiny house than it is a regular small build. So we did a really small kind of 78 square meter, which is actually quite big for us. Simple kind of rectangular barn style house with a pitched roof. So
that's cool. Yeah. I like that barn style. That's like my ideal also.
yeah, really, really easy to make for the builder. No, you know, funky lines or anything like that. It's just going to be quite straightforward.
My I've got a slight like homesteading dream, but my real dream is to hunt with the seasons and maybe move somewhere like southern Otago, where you go from fly fishing season. Obviously, you can hunt throughout the year, but then there's a birding season, so you can shoot quail, and then cool. duck season, and then have that freezer full with that. But yeah, you really need to put the time in. You know, I've got a mate who gets up twice a week at 4 a.m, and he goes out, and for every 3 or 4 times he goes, he shoots a deer. And I tend to sleep in the mornings and try and hunt on the weekend. So it does take a lot of time.
Yeah, sounds like a great lifestyle though.
Yeah, well, I try, and then success. How do you define success? Do you define success as just a good time out there, or do you define success as an animal down? So, that's all depend on that. Michael, so what does the future hold for homesteading in New Zealand? Is it just the growing culture? Has it always been there? What do you see the next 10, 20 years holds for homesteading?
I think if it's following the American wave, then it's just gonna grow.
It's
well documented on social media, like some of the you know, there's some huge accounts that people are just homesteading, you know, and they've got millions of followers, so the attention is there, and I think it just captures this desire for people to live on the land and to grow their own food and to kind of practice healthy, self-sufficient ways of living. And in New Zealand, I mean, our whole environment is just conducive to those types of aspirations anyway. You know, we've got these beautiful spaces and so much land, you know, still available for people to purchase. It's just a matter of, you know, of acquiring that and going down that road. But yeah, I just think it's going to keep growing and it's going to become more popular because it's back to basics. You know, that stuff never gets old. That kind of simple living mentality. A lot of people say it's how our grandparents used to, you know, like
where
they baked everything themselves and they knitted their own clothes and everything was done within the confines of the property.
Yeah, and it wasn't weird back then. It was just how it was.
Yeah, exactly. And people just got by without going to the store and buying something new.
Yeah.
And that's having such a renaissance in this era of wanton consumption and commercialization that, yeah, it's just going to become more and more appealing.
I feel like I've got two sides. I've got one side where I really like new things and I really like technology, like I like a carbon fiber stock on a rifle, you know, like the toys. And then on the other side, I really have this desire just to learn these skills. My sister stays on a farm in Botswana, and they're right in the north of Botswana, and their nearest town to the south is 300 kilometers away, and their nearest town to the north is I think 90 kilometers away. And so they kind of homestead by default.
Yes.
You know, they go do a once a month shop, but then that's it. You know, you've got to stock up. You have to grow some of your own stuff. I mean, they fill a freezer, etc. But if the bread's finished, you bake the bread, you know. And she said she's given up on buying bread now just because it goes off so quickly, or you have to always freeze it and then toast it, you know. So yeah, it's interesting. Just kind of some people do it because they want to live like that, and others get forced into it. And man, I really enjoy that talk. I think I'll go and pick up a copy of the magazine this weekend.
Cool, man.
And it's cool, just the mentality and also it's strange, you know. I never liked local newspapers, like kind of, you know, your Southland newspaper or your little local newspapers. But since I've moved to Invercargill, I kind of, that newspaper I used to take up and just throw into recycling, now I'm reading. And it goes with the same mentality. Someone opened a sourdough shop in town, and now I'm supporting that sourdough shop. I've now also started baking my own sourdough. I've killed many sourdough starter also. I'm looking at one now in the kitchen that's dead. I now officially have to put it in the bin. But it's interesting just, you know, supporting the community and doing your own thing and getting like a lot of gratification from that. And that's what I really like about the homesteading and that slight rebellious spirit to want to like do your own thing. So yeah, man, thanks. I enjoy that. And yeah, hopefully we'll meet sometime and
no worries, man.
Best of luck with everything.
Thank you. No, thanks for the chat. Great questions. And yeah, you've motivated me to apply for a gun license for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, on a property like yours, there'll probably be rabbits. So you can just have a 22 and have some good hair to eat.
Lots of rabbits. Yeah.
Cool. Sure. Michael, cheers. Thanks. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, thanks, Gerard. And I appreciate it.
Cheers.